I'm so glad to be here tonight and so glad you are joining us here at Truth Brigade on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We are going to be talking with the director, producer, and filmmaker, Brent Leung. He produced a House of Numbers, which you can find at houseofnumbers.com. It's just a, well, highly controversial, but extremely informative, just an excellent video, documentary about AIDS and HIV. You know, funny thing, though, he ended the movie and probably had more questions than he did when he started, and I have to admit, me too. So we awesome show in store for you, but he literally went all over the world, China, Australia, South Africa, Canada, Western Europe, just to kind of look at the procedures of the testing, what really is HIV, what really is AIDS, does HIV cause AIDS, what's being done to cure it, and he found, well, there's tens of billions of dollars going out towards this cause, but we just don't really even know what it is. And it was really astonishing to find out that you can take an AIDS test in one state or city or even another part of the city or just cross a border country or state and find out that you no longer have it. So, you know, the whole like the war on cancer or the war on drugs or any other war that the government has declared, there's obviously something behind it. And what is it more often than not? A ton of money and a lot of sick and dead and dying people. Well, yes, people are dying, but not from what we're told. Brent, it's so good to have you here tonight. I loved your film. Excellent documentary. And but I'm sitting here thinking, just like you when you finished the film, I have a heck of a lot more questions now than I did at the start of it. Can you tell us a little bit about your quest, what got you interested in this very serious and tragic topic?
Well, you know, coming from Canada, AIDS was never on my radar. It's not something that we really had to deal with growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were instances when I was growing up where, you know, if somebody had cut themselves, we worried about it. But I never knew anybody that allegedly was infected with HIV. So it wasn't on my radar. And then on my first trip to New York City with a friend, I was sitting in a diner and a complete stranger just started speaking to me. And he was telling me sort of what I thought were outlandish ideas, like HIV doesn't exist and AIDS is not a disease. And I sort of wrote him off, but I was, you know, what he said stuck with me. So when I returned home, I just started researching the matter. And you have to dig a little bit, but when you really start pouring into this research material, you find that, you know, giants in science have questioned the science surrounding HIV. People that are in the National Academy of Sciences, Nobel laureates, mm-hmm. Even the president of South Africa. So, although he's not a scientist. So there are a number of respectable people around the world that have questioned and continue to question this since the inception. And it seemed like a very fascinating topic. But what I certainly
So in Canada, you didn't know anyone personally who was affected?
No, not at all.
Okay. Okay, that's, you know, that we're going to, that quite, kind of makes me jump right into the film. Why is that? Why is it? Because I was looking at statistics, the AIDS.gov and all of their different sites today. And why is it that there isn't any HIV or AIDS in Canada?
Well, there is, but the numbers are extremely low. Like most places around in the developed world, there really is no HIV. I mean, it's, if you look at it, you know, purely by the numbers and not looking at individual lives, which is extremely important. But if you're looking at it from a statistical standpoint, it's not a big deal. You know, it's not a huge health concern, which is largely not echoed by myself, but from James Chin, who's in our film. He was the director of the Global HIV AIDS Surveillance, and in the film you'll hear him say mm-hmm. that you know, HIV is just not that big of a deal in the developed world at all.
Yeah, so shocking.
Yeah, I was shocked too. I thought a lot more people were impacted by it. But when I started researching this, what was even more odd is none of my friends knew anybody that was said to have HIV either. I mean, it was only when I started seeking out people to speak with that I finally met people that were diagnosed.
And you literally traveled all over the world. You didn't just look up a couple articles online and you did your homework. How long did it take you to put this film together?
The research phase started before the film and continued throughout the film and even into post-production. And that lasted around 9 or 10 years.
Wow.
And the actual shooting and the making of the film took about 3 years.
Okay. So when you finished the film, you had more questions than you did when you started?
I still have questions that I am unable to answer.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And that's a long... Okay, so 13 years, right? You look like a young guy, Brent. How old are you?
I'm 30. Well, it's not 13. The researching went through the filmmaking aspect of it as well. Even when we were editing, we were checking research just to make sure things were staying current and to make sure we were accurate. So, you know, you put the two together and it's about 10 years.
Okay, amazing. All right. Well, okay, let's, you know, first of all, I should probably save this question for the end, but I mean, everyone wants to know, what is AIDS? What is HIV? Does anyone really even know?
If you look at AIDS specifically, AIDS is it's a category, and different countries have different ways of defining that category. People can call it a syndrome. You know, it can be sort of semantics, but it's a category that was created and defined by the CDC in 1981, and it encompasses many other diseases, like cervical cancer, pneumocystis pneumonia, and compulsive sarcoma, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, how you define AIDS differs from country to country. HIV is said to be a virus that causes immune deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess the first official story was that it somehow jumped from monkeys to humans. Is there any truth to that? Or, I mean, first of all, how could a disease, a virus, jump from monkeys to humans?
Well, I am not a scientist myself, so I can't comment on that. I don't know how diseases jump from one species to another. What we look at in the film, and I think what's extremely important to look at, is going back to the fundamental, and that would be HIV itself, and is there evidence to prove the existence of a retrovirus?
Mm-hmm. Or because, is there any scientific evidence to prove that HIV causes AIDS?
Well, see, as a filmmaker and journalist, I have a real problem with that, because I think that's the wrong question, and I think it really muddies the water. To say HIV causes AIDS is to say HIV causes a category, which is defined differently all over the planet. I mean, the real question is there a virus called HIV? Does it cause immune deficiency? And when you have immune deficiency, you then can, your body is unsusceptible to these other infections.
Mm-hmm.
But AIDS, the definition of AIDS in our country has been expanded on 4 times, and a specific disease can't expand itself. So we're not talking about something that can kill you. It's not about does HIV cause AIDS, it's does HIV cause immune deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, basically the cause of all disease, I mean, even the so-called common cold or flu or, I mean, any disease is because of a suppressed or weakened immune system. So the name in itself, I mean, AIDS, acquired immune deficiency, you know, syndrome, I mean, basically anyone who's sick with anything has an immune deficiency.
That is true, but they have, well, this is where, this is, you know, why I have questions still, because the CDC will say you have to have HIV in order to get an AIDS diagnosis, which means you have any number of these diseases, which you brought up the fact that you have to have disease. You get disease when you're immune compromised. The other thing that's strange is the CDC also allows for people to be diagnosed with HIV and AIDS if they've never had an HIV positive test or if they've tested negative for HIV.
Yes, I was reading, I think some countries, you just have you lost weight, 10% or more, maybe have diarrhea and a diagnosis.
Yes, and what's interesting about that is that also differed from country to country. So some countries didn't think that definition worked properly from them, so they would alter it. And, you know, there's been so many different definitions of AIDS since the incept. It's I think it's personally ridiculous.
So basically, you can be diagnosed with AIDS in one country or state and cross a border and not have that same diagnosis. All of a sudden, you're well.
Yeah, like if you look at, take the U.S. and Canada, Canada did not choose to include a low T-cell count in their AIDS diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because that definition change was done for mainly insurance purposes. So it's at the height of when the CDC was actually reporting what different, if you want to call them diseases, or what the actual criteria was that someone was diagnosed with AIDS was when they still reported this. Over 60% at one point had been diagnosed because of a low T-cell count. So if you take, you know, 100% of all the AIDS cases in the United States, you cross the border, you know, 60% no longer have AIDS by definition.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, well, you have cancer in Pennsylvania, but not in Wisconsin. Okay, but they get away with that with AIDS. One thing was really surprising was, this was on AIDS.gov, 67% of those diagnosed with AIDS are living in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes, that's when you have to really start examining statistics. Because when you read that 67, you said 67%, correct?
Yes.
When you hear that 67% or, say, 25 million people have been diagnosed with, I don't even know if it's HIV or AIDS, what they're doing now, but when you hear that they have been, when you hear they are on sub-Saharan Africa, that doesn't mean that many people have actually been counted and diagnosed. Like in the developed world. Everything you hear coming from Africa and other third world countries is all based on statistical modeling, not off actual cases.
Okay. So even the numbers could be lying.
Well, you saw in 2007, India had a 60% decrease in their estimate. I mean, it's just baffling to think that, you know, you go to bed one night and wake up the next morning and 60% of your HIV cases are gone in the blink of an eye. It's because it's predominantly based on these statistics, which when you watch the film, it appears to be extremely flawed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I remember there was you talked about in the film, speaking of statistics, this house of numbers, in 97, I believe, it went down, but they changed the guidelines retroactively, making the numbers jump again.
In 93. In the United States,
93, okay.
The AIDS definition has changed four times, I believe. And every time they change the definition, the AIDS in this country expands. So you have more and more cases. What's interesting is if you look at the data, and if you just use the original definition, the AIDS statistics would be negligible.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, and part of the film, you went and got an AIDS test. Or HIV, whatever. Same thing, you got a test. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was in South Africa, and we went and got an HIV test. And what was really interesting was the location. You can get an HIV test anywhere in South Africa. Mm. And the closest one to us was a train station in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And the lady was taking, well, first you go through counseling and they ask you, you know, have you recently had sex? Are you gay? Are you an intravenous drug user? And I asked the counselor, you know, why she's asking me these questions, these risk assessment questions. And what they do is they use, per the package insert they gave us too, based on how you answer the questions, that will also determine the outcome of your test.
They did say that.
That doesn't seem very scientific to a layperson like myself. I mean, if your test is accurate, you shouldn't need to ask me anything.
DSM, right? Psychiatry. I mean, just sit around a table and, I mean, no, it doesn't sound very scientific at all.
Yes, and then you actually take the test, and the person administering the test basically says that the rapid test is useless. I mean, it really doesn't do anything. And it's not accurate at all. I mean, she was telling me that we're going to administer two tests in tandem to try to have a better outcome. And if the two tests conflict with each other, we're going to use a third test, which they call the tiebreaker test. And I asked her, is this test more accurate? And she said, yes. So the first problem is I'm being tested with two tests which aren't as accurate as their tiebreaker. So then I said, can you just use the tiebreaker test then? Because I would rather use the more accurate test. Which she responded, well, what if there's a problem with the accurate test? How will we ever know? Because there is no other test.
So basically three different tests, and none of them are 100% according to the testers.
None, and none of them follow the protocols which the developed world uses, which even they can't agree on their own protocols. It seems like HIV testing is fraught with some issues that really needs to be examined.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Now, okay, when you took your test, I guess you kind of knew going into it that, what they say might not necessarily be true. Or, because, I mean, I remember growing up and, oh, my gosh, if you have sex or kiss someone, you know, you're going to get AIDS and you're going to die. And, I mean, it was all over the place. Everywhere you go, everything you hear, everything you do, and fear, fear, fear. They had clinics everywhere. They'd be put up in parking lots like county buildings, malls, et cetera. Oh, get your AIDS test. And, you know, of course, the propaganda is like, oh, my gosh, I had premarital sex, so, you know, I must have it or something like that. And, of course, you know, if you are kind of in the medical system and you're taking their drugs, chances are you have symptoms and complications. So when I went and took, I mean, I remember the first test, I was scared to death. I mean, just, and I think you had to wait like 2 weeks at the time, but I was just terrified. And, you know, my other friends, a couple of them went, they were scared to death too, but the rest were just too scared to even go. So when you went and took your test, did you already know that there might be some questions in the tests or their efficiency, and of course, you know, the questions that you have with HIV and AIDS right now? Or was it kind of like me? Were you scared to death or any fear?
Well, going into it, I was pretty sure that I couldn't have it just because I really had zero risk. But I think you do feel extreme trepidation. I mean, I was shaking just because, I mean, if you test positive, the implications, aside from a medical diagnosis, are quite large. You know, if you test positive and you don't inform the person that you marry or I guess people that you sleep with, you can be sent to prison for grounds of, I think they call it attempted murder, or I think in the case of males, they say something like assault with a deadly weapon, which would be your, you know, area.
Amazing.
There's issues that could happen with immigration and traveling to certain countries. I mean, if people found out the stigma that is associated with it, I mean, it's it's a very scary diagnosis for anybody, and that's why I think the film is extremely important. Not just the film, but just the debate as a whole, putting the film aside. I think it's really important that people come together and really talk about a lot of the issues that are present in HIV and AIDS that surround the science, testing, statistics, treatment, everything. Because, you know, we can laugh about the HIV test I took, and it was quite funny how ridiculous it was.
But yeah. Well, you knew the right questions to ask and stuff, but I'm just assuming most of those people there, the lines of people, I heard from someone in New York today that they have them out in street fairs and festivals, and you walk in and they take a swab, and, you know, you walk around the fair and come back 40 minutes later with your diagnosis, but chances are, you know, they've never questioned any of this. So you kind of had the upper ground there for sure.
Well, that's the thing, too. Even in this country, you have to talk about how you diagnose HIV, because we definitely use what they call more specific tests, but these Western blots that they use are unbelievably problematic. In one lab in Maryland, which would be Dr. Robert Gallo's lab, I interviewed two technicians, and both technicians were using different criteria diagnosing an HIV-positive test on a Western blot. So it's not just Africa.
And they're in the same lab. Oh, my goodness. Okay, and that's in Bethesda, Maryland.
But, yeah, HIV testing for Western blots are different from lab to lab, country to country, continent to continent.
That's very interesting. Do you know who makes these tests, or is it possible, like the three tests you had in Africa, were they all made by the same people?
No, they all have to be made by different companies.
Oh,
and they claim
okay.
They have to be made with different technology.
Okay, so wow. All right, well, maybe next time you go, you'll have to take five different tests.
I don't ever intend on taking a test again.
Of course not. Okay, okay, so you know who some of the makers of these tests are. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I mean, if you just do a Google search, if you type in FDA-approved HIV test, you'll see Abbott Laboratories, Gold something, OraQuick or SureQuick. There's probably a couple dozen, Bio-Rad. There's about a couple dozen of them, and they'll all pop up in... You can actually read the package inserts as well. So if you know what you're looking for, you can see a lot revealed in the package insert. I mean, some of these package inserts say the tests are to be used as an aid in diagnosing HIV.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's an HIV test, right?
One of them said, you know, that, oh, yes, you unequivocally have AIDS, and then later on in the same insert it says, oh, well, this is just a tool or just one of the steps, be tested again type thing. So, yeah, they even admit they're not very accurate. But I guess I was wondering who the makers of the tests are to see if there's any connections with maybe the makers of AZT.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if Glaxo makes an HIV test. I'm not sure.
Ooh, let's see. Glaxo. Well, I'll look that up during the break. But, yeah, I'm just wondering, because this is a multi-billion, you know, maybe hundreds of billion-dollar industry, and I don't know. It's usually the people that put out the cure, the ones that put out the cause, so...
Oh, well, as Martin Delaney says, you know, in this film, people will be on drugs the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. So no cure.
Well, yeah, but what we've noticed, even in your film and other films and research, and, you know, everyone hears about it. They show pictures of the people on these drugs, and, yeah, they look sick. They're definitely dying of something. I mean, it's scary, but the people who don't take the drugs live ever since AIDS supposedly was invented.
Well, I actually would say that, for my experience, that's not completely true. I think there are people that are diagnosed with HIV that have definitely also gotten sick. And that by no means indicates HIV is the culprit. because tests aren't specific or accurate from the information that I gather and what has been told to me for diagnosing HIV. So, I mean, the issue is people have been sick since the beginning of time, and I think the thing that we have to get back to is really figuring out on an individual level, why are people getting sick? Why are people not getting sick? And why do people, when people take the drugs, do they get extremely sick, and a lot of them, pass away? And are the drugs the best treatment for people? It's not a clear-cut black-and-white issue by any means, but it's something that really needs to be extensively looked at and debated.
Absolutely. Why are people getting sick? And, you know, I mean, well, let's see, John Rappaport here says, but the disease is hunger, not AIDS. So, I mean, does AIDS even really exist? I mean, all disease is brought on by malnutrition, and then you look in populations where high concentrations of malnutrition, poverty, etc., are where the higher diagnoses or so-called rates of this disease.
That's another tough one, because in the developed world, you know, I've known people come down with cancer that they don't appear to have immune deficiency or malnutrition. Definitely in the third world, if you look at our interview with Luc Montagnier, I mean, he attributes almost everything in Africa to malnutrition, lack of sanitation, problem with antioxidants and oxidative stress and things of that nature. So I think when you're looking at Africa, I don't think you can, I think it's really just wrong to look at, to really focus on AIDS right now when we should be focusing on really, you know, infrastructure, sanitation,
exactly,
providing clean water for people.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, do we even know how much money we're spending on AZT or supposedly helping people with this disease that might or might not exist? I mean, because it probably is enough money to feed these people or anyone, or even teach us. I mean, heck, I know hardly any people in America that know how to feed themselves. But I mean, really, that I think that you're right, that would be a much better investment of all of this money.
Yeah, it's hard to know the official numbers because there's so many NGOs and different organizations that give money. But, you know, we do know that the Bush administration did approve about $40 billion for the treatment of HIV, with obviously drugs being the main portion of that figure.
Okay. All right. So obviously it's in their interest to keep that up.
Just one thing. There's a man named Joe Sonnabin who is featured in the film, and he does believe in HIV. But one thing he talks about in the film and in his extended interview is that a large portion of Africa is purely driven by money. And I think that's the first thing we have to look at with this thing. You know, we have to focus on the money and the money trail and where the money is going and who's getting it and who's giving it and what benefits there are from that.
Wow. Definitely. Very good question. I came across an article, let's see, Boyd Graves here. It says that, all right, it starts off, the United States, here we go. The true history of the origin of AIDS can be traced throughout the 20th century and back to 1878. Is that true?
From my opinion, and from the research I've done, I would say it's not true at all. I mean, we know when AIDS came about, it was 1981, and that's because people decided to create a definitional category and put diseases that have existed for long periods of time in that category.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a category. It's nothing. It's a way to do statistical modeling for the developed world as well.
Oh, absolutely. Well, like any disease, it's basically just a set of symptoms, and okay, here's your label, here's your tag, and instead of addressing it. But yeah, I just found this really interesting because this, let's see, this report here, where can we find this? Boyd E. Graves, J.D. It's a chapter expert from State Origin, The Evidence of Laboratory Birth of AIDS. And then it goes on talking to late 1800s up to in 1931, it says that we secretly tested African Americans and tested AIDS in sheep. I mean, in 1931, I thought it was in the 80s when we first heard of this.
Well, you know, the one thing that we did in our film was we tried to be as credible as possible, and that's going to the people with the credentials, people that have written scientific papers, that have accolades. I would be leery to believe anything Mr. Graves says simply on the fact that he confuses HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's talking about HIV being made in the laboratory and HIV testing on black people. He doesn't even get his language right. So it seems very sensational, but it doesn't seem that argument holds any water and is based purely in the conspiracy realm.
Okay, so you've read this then.
Oh, yeah, in doing research, I talked to everybody I could find on all sides of every issue, and I talked to Graves a long, long, long time ago.
Okay, because, I mean, we hear about eugenics, and, I mean, clearly something is going on, but I do believe a lot of it's kind of fear-mongering. But something I read in this kind of stood out. It said, let's see, M.K. Naomi says that it's the code name for the development of AIDS. The M.K. portion stands for the two co-authors, and the Naomi portion stands for Negroes are only momentary individuals. And I didn't find anything to back that up, but then I Googled, of course, M.K. Naomi, and it says, well, on Wikipedia, that it was a name for Joint Department of Defense CIA research program lasting from the 50s through the 70s. Unclassified information about the program and related special ops divisions is scarce. It's generally reported to be a successor to MK Delta and to have focused on biological projects, including biological warfare agents, specifically to store materials that could either incapacitate or kill a test subject and to develop devices for the diffusion of such materials.
Well, I try not to be too conspiratorial in nature, and I'm sure the government does all kinds of CD testing with biological weapons and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we really have to look at is what is the evidence for HIV's existence? Why are the tests so flawed? Why are the statistics so flawed? Why does the treatment not work as well as we'd like it to work? I mean, there's so many issues already surrounding the HIV hypothesis to throw in something that isn't backed at what I can see at all by any kind of science whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There's really to muddy an already very cloudy issue. I mean, what is his scientific name for HIV being man-made? Like, when does he say HIV was created?
Well, you know, different people say different things, and, you know, I was just wondering if you had come across anything that could back any of that up. I mean, specifically the Naomi. I mean, I've heard of a lot of crazy projects, and I know at least most of them are real, but I had never heard. It was quite shocking today to find something even called that. So even if they're just kind of, I mean, even if it's not real, I mean, Negroes are only momentary individuals. It was just kind of scary. I don't know. I mean, there's, you know, of course, the Club of Rome and different groups, of course, say that, you know, they'd like to, or Prince Charles or whatever. Not Prince Charles. What am I thinking? Okay, I'm playing Monopoly here. But, you know, say they'd like to come back as a virus or a germ, and, of course, Bill Gates. And, you know, so there's a lot of talk of that, but I just don't know if there's any substantiated evidence to back that up. But, you know, so, I mean, moving on to the HIV thing, though, some say it has been isolated, others say it hasn't. Has it really been isolated, and if so, who says that they have isolated and photographed HIV?
Well, that, as the interviews will say in the film and in the extended interviews, that depends on your definition of an isolate, which is also cloudy. But
Pasteur Institute set guidelines for virus isolation did they follow these guidelines, or have these guidelines been followed, or have they been kind of relaxed?
Well, I think that is the ultimate question. I mean, it's not just isolation, but you have to go through a process called purification, and that's how you indeed prove that you have a virus and how you extract the proteins from the virus so you can make a test. And I am not a scientist, so I don't think it would be appropriate for me to comment on that either way. All I know is that the protocols that are supposed to be used to isolate and purify a virus, as told by the establishment interviews to me, do not appear to have been followed in the publications that came out in 1983, then in 1984, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, did you ask anyone else to isolate it or photograph it in your working on your film?
No, we talked with a man named Hans Gelderblum, who is by far the world's foremost expert on electron microscopy for viruses. And he was showing me pictures of virus that he had taken in culture. He's also, I believe, to this date, still published more pictures of HIV than anybody else. And as he was showing me pictures and we were talking about it, I was pointing to things saying, well, is this one HIV? Because it, you know, it doesn't have the morphological attributes. And I would point, and he would say, and twice he said to me, probably, probably. Now, the issue is these are pictures that have already been published and labeled HIV, and here we are many, many years later calling them probably. And him and he talked quite a lot about how electron microscopy is very dependent on interpretation as well.
So probably based on anyone's interpretation at the moment.
I mean, it's all subjective, but it doesn't matter, because even Luc Montagnier says you can't take a picture of a virus in culture and diagnose that's HIV, because there's other things that have similar morphological attributes as well, or that look the same.
All right. Well, you brought up Luc. Isn't he the one that won the Nobel Prize for supposedly discovering HIV?
Him and his partner François Barré-Sanoussi.
So, and discovered it, what, in 2008?
Well, he's the first to publish the finding of what they called lab at the time. But I don't want to get into the scientific aspects too much, because, one, I'm not a scientist, but, two, I don't want to bore your listeners. there's a very critical step that needs to be taken, and that's photographing the virus in a certain way during the purification process. And it's something that every person that I interviewed said was vital, including Montagnier.
Well, it's according to their own guidelines.
Well, it's almost everyone's guidelines, and the thing is, even though they say it's vital, Dr. Montagnier and Dr. Gallo did not do that when they published their papers in 83 and 84.
Well, what's interesting to me, okay, so the early 80s, they say, you know, HIV, this new disease, everybody watch out, but then it's, you know, 2008, and oh, we just barely discovered it? That seems a little fishy.
Oh, no, Montagnier allegedly discovered it in 1983, and then Gallo...
Okay, so it was 81, I'm sorry. Was it 81 when they came out with it?
81 is when Michael Gottlieb... said he observed something that was different, and that's sort of what got the ball rolling. And then in 82, 83, they started doing experiments thinking that a retrovirus was the cause, and 83 is when Montagnier published his findings, and then 1984, Gallo published his findings.
Okay, so then, yeah, that's just what just seems fishy to me, is that how many people were diagnosed in that time, and they didn't even know what they were diagnosing?
Well, what I think is interesting is Harry Habercross is somebody that was tasked by the CDC to define AIDS for them, and was also on the task force. And I asked him if they went back and tested all the blood samples and the people that they had diagnosed with AIDS before the HIV test came on the market, and he said they didn't. So we really have no way of knowing whether people before 1985 were positive. But that of course, you know, holds the question, how accurate was that first test? Because they would say it wasn't very accurate at all.
Yeah, and they're not even accurate today. So, yeah. Okay, so getting back to the, you know, isolating viruses, let's just say I'm a scientist, and I isolated the herpes virus. Would all my colleagues just take my word for it, or would they also try to isolate it, photo it, and kind of prove the same results?
Well, in the perfect world, everybody, there should be a lot of people who can reproduce the findings that you have and can verify all the data from your experiments.
Mm-hmm.
That was the case with the 1984 announcement that HIV was the probable culprit.
Okay, like, so every other virus, it's, you know, anyone else can isolate it and follow the same guidelines, but with AIDS or HIV, basically everybody just followed the first guy's assertion, and that's it, end of story.
Well, I don't know if they haven't. They would claim they have. I'll give you a really interesting example. When Luc Montagnier, in 1983, published his landmark paper, basically claiming to discover the cause of immune deficiency, we'll call it. He said that he had isolated a C-type virus. And when Robert Gallo in 1984 published his findings, he found a C-type virus. When Jay Levy in California in 1984 published his findings, he saw a D-type virus. And this may just sound like, you know, C, D, you know, just letters, but it's extremely important because when you talk to an electron microscopist like Hans Gelderblum, you know, this is the difference of seeing a car versus a human, a male versus a female, or even an ape. So what everybody agrees upon today is that HIV is something called a lentivirus because it has a unique look with it's what they call a cone-shaped core, which they can see in the electron microscope. Hmm. So when I interviewed Hans Gelderblum, I asked him, why did Montagnier and Gallo see C-type when they published their papers? And he said, quote, because they had it in the brain. And I said, oh, they saw what they wanted to see? And he said, yes.
Oh,
so
wow.
You have the two landmark papers which, you know, allegedly proved that they found a new virus, but that was a C-type. Jay Levy in San Francisco saw a D-type, and today it's a lentivirus. So you can see it's extremely confusing, and HIV very well may exist. All we're doing is saying that there are a lot of questions, and these questions deserve to be recognized and
oh,
answered.
Yeah.
Because I don't have I don't have a stake in any particular view. I don't think mm-hmm. anybody really does accept those profiting off of the message, either way.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, and yeah, you interviewed both sides and such, wasn't? But they all had conflicting views on it. Oh no, we'll never find a cure. You're doomed to die. And then there were others that just simply said, better nutrition would reverse, if not remove entirely, this so-called virus.
Yeah, that was the most surprising, I would say shocking statement that was uttered, Luc Montagnier said that if you have a healthy immune system, you can clear HIV naturally, which I clarified, and I asked him one more time. You're saying if you have a good immune system, you can clear it, and he says yes. And I said, what if you take, you know, a poor African and you give them proper sanitation, nutrition, clean drinking water, would they be able to get rid of it? And he said, I would think so.
Yes.
I mean, that is enormous. That is unbelievable. It's earth-shattering. And yet the established scientific community refuses to address it, talk about why he said it, or even investigate it.
Okay, well, of course, in the late 70s, they gave out free hepatitis B vaccines in New York, San Francisco, and L.A., predominantly to the homosexual community. Many say that this vaccine contributed to the outbreak. Or the so-called pandemic.
This is going back to the man-made thing. I don't know if you can. I mean, okay, well, to give it a fair shake, I guess, then you'd have to explain also how Germany also had their outbreak in the homosexual community, and other developed countries had their outbreak first in the homosexual community. It wasn't just the United States. And I don't know, but whoever is espousing that would have to also show that hepatitis B vaccines were also administered to those groups as well. But if you look at what the CDC says in 1981, 82, and early 83 and thereon, the sort of unifying factor of all the people that came down with this immune deficiency had one thing in common, which was poppers or amyl nitrite inhalant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something else that you can look at, and I'm sure there's a wider range of other things to look at as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, they promoted HIV and AIDS being a lifestyle choice, and that's true, but not what they're telling us. I mean, as we've touched on already, the malnutrition, things like that, and when people are staying up all night doing poppers or whatever, drinking alcohol or, you know, engaging in those types of behaviors, not getting enough sleep, sunshine, nutrition, etc., you're going to have a weakened immune system. So you don't know, you're not aware of any relation to vaccines that were given out in the 70s to the epidemic, or as they called the pandemic of AIDS?
I mean, I think maybe one could investigate whether the vaccines were potentially contaminated with other forms of bacteria or disease. But if the question is trying to get at were the vaccines, the hepatitis B vaccine, specifically laced with HIV to introduce a new disease to the gay community? I don't think there's any evidence for that at all.
Okay. All right. Maybe not. But, you know, we do have doctors saying that they did introduce certain viruses through vaccines to certain populations and countries. In fact, there's been a number of lawsuits, and I read a little bit about one. Let me ask you this. Why did Bill Clinton pardon Dr. Gallo?
Oh, from the from allegedly stealing the virus from Montagnier?
Yeah.
I would have to do research on. I wasn't aware that Clinton pardoned Gallo. I thought that the Office of Scientific Integrity cleared up Gallo's situation before Clinton came into office. But all that, if people are interested in that, they should read John Crutzen's book called Science Fiction, which is extremely fascinating, and that talks all about the politics around the search for what they call HIV and what Gallo did or did not do and how that was handled.
What's that book again?
It's called Science Fictions, and I think that the subline is The Dark Legacy of Dr. Robert Gallo, or something to that effect.
Okay,
but I
science fiction. Okay, because didn't he, I mean, he admitted to making viruses and biowarfare, et cetera.
You know, I've heard that, and I know that he was involved in Richard Nixon's special cancer virus program, which a lot of people were. But what his specific role was and what he did, I don't know. The question that we would like on the table, though, is there evidence for HIV's existence? Because looking at the evidence that is presented, it's the anecdotal evidence presented by people that say that, I guess, Robert Gallo sliced together, I don't know what they say, bovine something virus and sheep stuff. It's very difficult to digest when you break it down and you continue to ask questions about that theory. I mean, it seems to break down quite quickly.
So how long did you talk with Dr. Gallo? Did you ask him any of these things?
Well, by the time I interviewed Gallo, and again, this is all subjective, of course. By the time I interviewed Gallo, and I interviewed him twice, I had written this theory completely off.
Okay.
Because I had talked to Len Horowitz also, and Robert Strecker, and Boyd E. Graves, and it's what they say is extremely difficult when you apply science to it.
Okay, so, but there are a lot of people saying that. I mean, you know, Gallo himself admitted that he's played with vaccines. The statistics, proves that, you know, something's going on with vaccines. But I guess he didn't divulge any of that to you. Did he admit to you at all playing with deadly viruses?
Well, I mean, I don't think he tried to hide it. I think everybody knows that these scientists do tend to experiment around with extremely deadly strains of viruses or, I don't know, other forms of disease. But he very well may have. We did not talk about that in relation to HIV, though.
Okay. What about, it seemed like some of them got upset when you asked them simple questions.
Oh, can you tell me how to isolate HIV?
Yeah.
Well, that goes back again to...
That was funny.
The whole question of HIV's existence. I mean, it's... From what I gather from talking to these guys, it's a very uncomfortable topic to talk about, you know, the evidence for whether HIV exists or not.
Yeah, and just accept what we're telling you. Don't expect us to check it out ourselves, and don't you dare question me. Just accept it, right?
Yes.
Who was the guy that told you to do your own homework?
That was David Baltimore, who was the former president of Caltech and Nobel laureate, or co-Nobel Prize winner for discovering reverse transcription, reverse transcriptase.
Mm-hmm. And what was his position?
Oh, he believes that HIV is a deadly virus that is that puts us all at risk.
Puts us all at risk. It, like, we can just catch it, or catch it through sexual contact, saliva, sharing drinks, or drug use, I guess?
No, I mean, whatever CDC and NIH put out this year, I'm sure that that's what he falls in line with.
Okay.
Although, from watching the film, one of the other fascinating things that came up, because when I was growing up, I was always taught, you know, if you have sex with one person and they have it, you're going to get it and you're going to die.
Yeah, they said that.
What was really interesting was, you know, Nancy Padian had a 10-year study, which people claim different interpretation on, but the fact is she had, there was no transmission from an infected person to an uninfected person. And even James Curran, who was the former director of the CDC, says that the risks of contracting HIV are extremely low. That's not the message that we get.
Okay.
Even today.
So if they're not getting it through sex and drug use, how are they getting it, if it even exists?
That's why I always go back to that one question that I wish people would ask and they would research. What is it, and does it exist?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, obviously, people are sick, and you know, people are dying of something. But yeah, I was hoping I'd watch the movie and I'd finally find out what that was. And just like you, I ended up with even more questions. Who was that female doctor that got visibly upset with you?
Female doctor.
Yeah. Let me go through this list. Oh, was it? Oh, the German lady, I think, Claudia Kircherer, or I'm not sure how you say that name.
Oh, maybe there's okay. A thing where she came across annoyed, but we had a great conversation after, so I don't, she was nothing like David Baltimore. She was a very nice lady.
Okay.
But you know, what was interesting about her interview is she's the one that really brought up the fact that different governing bodies use different ways to interpret the Western blot. And I asked her, well, if you test positive on one criteria and negative on the other, how do you decide who's infected or not? And she really had to pause and think about her answer.
And yeah, I was wondering, do you think she's going to go home and start rethinking all of what she thought she knew?
No,
just from those few simple questions.
Not at all. She's part of a group of, I think, 18 scientists that wrote a letter before they even saw the film, saying that I had hoodwinked them and that the film was non-scientific and promoted views that were deadly to people and all this other stuff. So I don't think she's going to rethink anything.
Okay. Tell us about Peter Duisberg.
Peter Duisberg is a scientist in Berkeley, California, who I believe was the first U.S. scientist to question HIV's role in causing disease.
Mm-hmm. And how did his colleagues accept him? How did that turn out?
Oh, yes. Well, he has a story where Good Morning America was interested in talking about his views, and they flew him, you know, first class to New York City, put him up in a five-star hotel. And he says the night before, he got a call, and they said he had to be bumped for something more important, but that they would call him back and reschedule.
Oh, wow.
So when he woke up the next morning, he turned on Good Morning America, and the important bump was Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease giving the exact opposite message that Peter was going to give. And it's really amazing the censorship that we have on this issue in a country where we're supposed to have freedom of speech and a free press. I mean, it's just unbelievable that there is no tolerance for talking about this whatsoever.
Yeah, well, tell us, what has it been like for you? I mean, I know you've won some film festivals and such, but what about in the medical community, or what type of feedback have you been getting?
Well, I've heard from people that are just on the ground that don't have an investment in this. I mean, the feedback has been tremendous. We've had nurses come up and just rave about the information and talk about it. People that were a little upset, but we were able to have a civil discussion, which is always fantastic, because I think you should challenge everything. I mean, don't take what our film says is golden and believe it. Everything you take in should be questioned. But when you look at, I guess what we have to really call it, just the establishment, the hard line that there's a single cause, a single disease, and a single cure, from those people, it's been really nothing but ad hominem arguments. I have been accused of so many different things. It's unbelievable. But they refuse to engage in any kind of dialogue with me. They refuse to debate the issue at all. It's a complete blackout. There's been a lot of misrepresentations on their part. Two scientists came forward and said that they were taken out of context. So I released that section of the that footage with me asking the question and with their complete answer to show they weren't out of context, and then nothing was spoken. There was no apology. It's just really tremendous. I mean, it's not something that you would expect from very professional people.
So you're saying that two of the scientists in the movie said that you took them out of context after it was produced?
Yes, Dr. Robin Weiss and Dr. Neil Constantine said that on text, and that we were talking about completely different things. So I released, unedited with time code, my question, their answer.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Okay. I mean, it
sounds like
up to viewer interpretation, but I would argue that they were not taken out of context in the slightest bit at all.
Yeah, so maybe they're being questioned or frowned upon within their community or their circles.
Yes, I mean, you know, there's a huge investment in HIV. Again, that doesn't mean that HIV doesn't exist. It doesn't mean it doesn't cause immune deficiency. But we can't not look at the investment. There's accolades. There's tens of billions of dollars, funding scientific research, AIDS vaccination research, new drug therapies. If you go to Africa, there are so many people in different communities that are now funded because of HIV dollars. And that's not just the people that are working on the science. It's people that are working on the ground, the NGOs. Rian Milan, who's interviewed in the film, talks about, I can't remember right now, but a certain country in Africa that he went to.
Do you know who's behind the money?
Well, the federal government is behind a large portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every country will have their own entity which is behind the money. Or, you know, the Gates Foundation contributes quite a lot. You have the Red Campaign, which generates a lot of money for HIV or AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. I mean, nonprofits play a big role in charity fundraising. So, and then, of course, the pharmaceutical companies.
Of course.
Which have a quite substantial investment in the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you know who makes AZT?
Originally, Burroughs Wellcome made AZT. And if research serves me correctly, I believe they also were one of the makers of one of the poppers drugs that were used, heavily used.
The makers of the poppers and AZT are the same people. Now, wasn't AZT previously banned in cancer trials? Actually, not trials, after killing people.
It's been a while since I looked at that research. I thought it was developed in the 60s for cancer chemotherapy, but it was so toxic that it was shelved, and they didn't even patent it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which, as we know, pharmaceuticals patent everything today.
Yeah, so of course they had to just repackage it, essentially. But do you know how much do people pay to get their monthly dose of AZT?
Well, AZT is no longer given today in monotherapy, so you would never just get AZT. You would get a cocktail, which includes protease inhibitors, nucleoside analogs, fusion inhibitors, and things like that. One person I talked to, I believe 14 or 15,000 was the monthly payment.
So AZT plus a cocktail of several other pills.
But again, I don't think everybody gets AZT today either, because they have similar drugs in that class. Like I think nevirapine is in that class. I can't remember at the moment. But I mean, there's a barrage of drugs now that people have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always need more drugs, right? Does insurance and Medicare always pay for these?
This is actually a really fascinating topic. Their insurance and government pays for quite a lot. There was a gentleman that we interviewed who his rent was paid for, his contact lenses were paid for, and they were $11,000 a piece. They supported him in a way where Albertsons would bring groceries to his house every week. There was another service which was paid for him for his cat, so that his cat could be taken care of. They get discounts on drugs, not just HIV drugs, but other drugs as well. They get all kinds of discounts. I mean, there's a gentleman, I don't know if you remember in the film, who was said to have AIDS because of a low T-cell count, and he had a handicap placard in his car, which he could use. And he had never been sick. He had no sign of disease, but, you know, he talked about the fact that if they're going to hand him a handicap placard, he's going to take it because it'll make his life easier.
Yeah, and there was also people that had never been sick that have home health care aides or people to clean their home and such for them.
Yes, that's another.
That sounds like tremendous benefits.
Yes, and the question is, who's paying for it? And
exactly, who's paying for it? I mean, probably 60% of the people maybe are insured here in America, different types of insurance or Medicare. But what about in Africa? How do they pay for their AZT and other drugs?
I think we do.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think a large part of it is the developed world taste for all those drugs.
So basically, our government's paying for our drugs, and our government is pretty much transferring money to what, these other countries, or straight to the drug companies to go treat everyone.
I'm not going to speak to the accuracy of this, but I will tell you it was a very interesting quote by one of the interviewees who said that the allocation of the Bush dollars, the $50 billion, was nothing more than a redistribution of wealth from middle-class America to the rich pharmaceutical companies via the World Bank and some other international fund relief organization.
Yeah. Okay, not surprising. Just follow the money, as always. Now, what about Magic Johnson? He didn't take the drugs, right?
Yeah, I have heard a lot of varying rumors about Magic Johnson, and I've gotten nothing conclusive, so I have no idea. I do know that he gets paid around $15 to $20 million, though, to lend his face for advertising purposes for HIV drugs.
Oh, wow. Okay, but he's probably not taking them himself. Okay, do you know the longest someone has survived on AZT?
I don't think anybody. The longest they've survived on it?
Mm-hmm. Year, maybe, 6 months, 2 years? 30
hard
days?
That's hard to tell because almost everybody that took it died.
Yeah, I think everyone who did take it dies, but I'm just wondering the longest that anyone's ever been able to survive on it.
I don't know. If you look at the initial prescription, it was like 15 milligrams, I believe, or 1,500. And then it was cut in half, and then it was cut in half again, and then it was cut in half. And Joe Sonnabend, who is in our deluxe edition, talks about that because he worked a lot with AZT. And he calls it a DNA chain terminator. So they all admit in the film itself that the dosing was wrong in the beginning and probably harmed everybody. I don't think there's anybody that questions that anymore.
Yeah. Okay, let me...
You wait long enough and people will admit things, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, when everybody's dead, I mean, how long can you go on denying it, right? What about the boxer, Tommy Morrison? Wasn't he diagnosed with AIDS or HIV, and then I guess 11, 12 years later, he had multiple tests that said he didn't have it?
Yeah, Tommy's actually a very interesting story because they can't even locate his original HIV-positive test now that he received. So, yeah, he did test positive, and what's interesting is he also had a viral load. I don't know the number, but as they'll tell you when you go in, or anybody that has been diagnosed will tell you, that viral load, along with T-cell count, is used to decide when to initiate treatment, and talks about how much virus is in your body. So that's another interesting question we have to ask. You know, if he had a viral load test and if he had a viral load count and now the HIV tests are negative, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, I'd like to know what's going on. I mean, he was diagnosed, I guess, just after signing a big contract, right?
I don't know the particulars of that, but that's what I hear. He had a pretty substantial purse for Box and...
Yeah, that. Something like $40 million. Wow.
Right.
Amazing. It's that time again, Brent. Hold that right there. We will be right back after this short break. And check it out, houseofnumbers.com will seriously raise some questions about what we think we know about AIDS, HIV, but stay tuned. We'll be right back. Just a few minutes left here, but Brent, let me start off with a comment that just came up on the chat. Anon says, you all should pull your head out of your behinds. I changed that word there. Do you really believe there isn't a virus that is called HIV?
Well, I would respond to her by saying I never said I believe there wasn't a virus called HIV, but what we're talking about is questioning the evidence that is put forth and reopening the argument. If she is dead certain there is a virus called HIV, you should ask her maybe what scientific paper she's referencing and why the tests are so inaccurate, why we can't have any accurate tests, why we have no accurate way of testing for HIV around the world, why there's so much disagreement, why the statistics are so flawed, why there's so many problems in curing the alleged virus. All of it harks back to the original question, is there a virus?
Hopefully they'll get the movie and, you know, go check it out, houseofnumbers.com, and see for yourself. But if you do have proof of that virus, pretty please let us know, because we would really like to see it. I'd like to answer these questions. And speaking of questions, you said after the film you had more questions than you did before. So what are those more questions that you have now?
Oh, I think taking everything we know, I would like to sit down, you know, one-on-one with some of these people and really start asking, you know, what is the evidence for HIV's existence, and present all the information that is put forth that questions whether there is a virus. And also, I say ask questions, but also really getting answers that address the direct question and not workarounds. But, you know, how come there is not an established set of tests for testing for HIV? Yeah. And you know what's even more fascinating is if you look at the evolution of Western blot testing. It's really tragic on a humanitarian level because it's affected so many people. On the other side, it's fascinating that it's changed just as much as AIDS has.
And, so basically, the same person can go get tests at two or three or, you know, different places, and one will say no and one will say yes, depending on how you answer your questions.
Well, there's a gentleman in San Francisco that I spoke with who went in for testing, and he had a positive and a negative on a rapid test. So they sent him for further testing with the Western blot to two different labs. Again, he had a positive and negative. So he went back and he answered the questions differently. So he basically established that he had no risk. And then on both tests, he had a negative. Mm. So I have no idea.
And what about the other woman in your film? She what? Got seven at least tests? Yes, no, yes, no, no, no. I mean, it's just, yeah. You know what? Show us the virus, pretty please. Whoever's there in the text chat. Let me ask you this. I mean, you went all over the world and worked on this project for 10 years. It's certainly enormous. How the heck did you fund all of that?
Oh, we were very lucky. We had people that really believed in what we were doing, which in the beginning was mainly aimed at education. So we had some people come forward that just wanted to get involved, and as the film progressed, more people came involved, and we met more people and showed them the film, and, you know, we were just very fortunate. We also had a fantastic crew that, you know, really helped out, and, you know, nobody was paid what they were supposed to be paid. Some people didn't get paid at all, and you know, the film was very fortunate to have such a fantastic group of people working on it, because this was a group effort. It could not have been done by one person.
Okay, so just individuals, just you happen to be in circles with really cool people.
Yes, and then people that knew people, and, you know, it just evolves, and that's one of the great things about creating something.
Okay, well, gosh, we are almost out of time here, so let me ask you this. What other projects are you currently working on?
We're looking at starting a documentary right now addressing the issue of people that are homeless in this country, and also looking at doing some pieces on religion.
Ah, that'll be a good one. Okay, but you also have extra video coming out, supplementary information to this documentary, right?
Yes, starting in December or January, we are going to start releasing extended interview footage that wasn't on the deluxe. From all the interviewees, and this addresses the question of HIV's existence to the very beginning, what was going on, more on HIV testing. It covers everything.
Brent, thank you so much for your time tonight and all your work putting forth all of these questions, more questions. Thank you again.
Thank you. I had fun. I appreciate it.
Awesome. You've been such a delight. Thank you all for being here tonight. Abundant blessings and love to all. Have a beautiful weekend. AmericanFreedomRadio.com.